You know, the more I study the Bible and think about the Bible and the revelation of God, the Lord's wonderful friend, he's got a sense of humor. He does some very interesting, one might say, without giving it a cheap color, he does some fun things in the Bible. He reveals his will in certain very interesting ways. And we're going to think about one of those ways in which he has revealed his will. And as we go into it, there are some presuppositions that we must remind ourselves. One is that you cannot alter perfection. When it's perfect, it's perfect, it's perfect. Do anything to it, it gets more perfect, it wasn't perfect. You can't make a piece of white paper whiter. It wasn't white before. But once it becomes white, it's unalterable. God is perfect. God is unalterable. I, the Lord, change not. With him there is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Those are presuppositions. God doesn't change. The way he behaves yesterday is the way he behaves today, is the way he's going to behave forever. You can settle it. You can know it. You can rest in it. If you think about it, there are a thousand ways that we take for granted that God is totally predictable. How many of you, within sound of my voice, are a little nervous and apprehensive while you're sitting on those chairs that you might suddenly become weightless and airborne? Any of you got any anxieties like that? No. I hope not. I don't think they've got any extra rooms in St. Elizabeth, but you'd be wandering there. Why is it that you are sitting comfortably? Because something right in the middle of this planet is pulling you down to the center. Now, this tent is not anchored to anything. It's just sitting here by its own weight. Gravity is an attribute of this planet that we have learned to take for granted. And I could spend the rest of the evening giving you illustrations of the things of life and nature that we have learned to take totally for granted. Because God and his methods and his working are predictable. You breathe, you eat, you sleep, you've done it 1,000 times, you hope to do it 1,000 times more. Things function. You get to know them, that's the way they work. You don't worry about them at all. If you start worrying about your lungs or your heart or your kidneys or your liver or your stomach, there's something the matter. Everything is going finely. God's providences are working out. Seed time and harvest, summer and winter, day and night, don't change. Settle that in your mind. So when you get acquainted with how God worked yesterday or yester century or yester millennium, that's the way he's going to work today. That's why this book is such a treasure. Helps us to become acquainted with God. Now, the next presupposition comes from Amos chapter 3. The Lord God will do nothing, but he will reveal his secret to his servants, the prophets. Same in every age. And he reveals what he is going to do to his servants, the prophets. And then Christ gave another premise, another axiom. Behold, I have told you before it has come to pass, that when it is come to pass, he might believe. See, belief, faith, confidence, trust is built on fulfilled prophecy. I am very little interested in speculation about the future. I don't know how the Sunday laws are going to come. I don't worry in the slightest. I don't know how the sifting is going to work out. I can make a long list of the things I don't know anything about. They're in the future. I don't worry about them. I can speculate for the best when I get together with the students in my class. I'll give you my guesses. And I'll sign them. Guess number one, guess number two, guess number three. Let's see how it's going to work out. But I know from my study of the Bible and history that nobody has pre-guessed how a prophecy is going to be fulfilled. Do you know that? They didn't know how the prophecy of Christ's crucifixion was going to be fulfilled. When it was all finished, they said, why didn't we see it? This is that which was spoken. Where were we? Our brains were in Venus. It's when it has come to pass that we suddenly see it. And we can believe. Don't worry about speculation. Very interesting to some people how things are going. They make a scenario of way things pass. Well, if it's made a scenario, keep it that way. That's so-and-so's guess. Take it for what it's worth. And then as life comes, modify it and keep going. And then when it's fulfilled, it probably will be quite different. But my faith doesn't need unfulfilled prophecy. My faith rests on fulfilled prophecy when it has come to pass. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of prophecies that have come to pass. Somebody has said there are 500, I haven't counted them, different little prophetic bits and pieces that were fulfilled in the first advent of Christ. Make a list sometime. All the things that were told from Genesis 3 on through Malachi 4. The deal with the coming of Christ. And you can rest your faith on those wonderful things. God never changes. God reveals his purpose. Faith rests on fulfilled prophecy. Now, how does God do some of these things? Let's find the 9th chapter of Romans. Paul here is writing his epistle to the Romans. See, there were 3 marks over Christ. One in Latin for the Romans, one in Greek for the Hellenistic world, and one in Hebrew for the Israelites. And there are 3 big epistles. Romans gives Christ for the Romans, Hebrews gives Christ for the Hebrews, and Corinthians gives Christ for the Greeks. Now when he writes to the Latins, he reminds them in verse 25 of Romans 9. Now follow this carefully. He, that is God, saith also in O.C., that's Hosea, I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And then, ye are my people, these shall be called the children of the living God. And so the call of the Gentiles is given. Now, where does Hosea make the prophecy of those shall not be my people, and others shall be my people. And those shall not receive mercy, while others will receive mercy. Let's go back and look in Hosea chapter 1. And this is very interesting. The Lord tells Hosea, go get married. So he goes and finds a young woman by the name of Gomer. And she has a son. And God says, call his name Jezreel. Now we won't deal with Jezreel tonight. In verse 6, and she conceived again and bore a daughter. And God said unto him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah. And verse 8, when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bore a son, and God said, call his name Lo-Ami. What does all this mean? Now, Ruhamah means receive grace or receive mercy. And lo is the negative particle, not receive. It's like un. Charitable and uncharitable. Ruhama, lo ruhama. Then in verse 9, his name was Lo Ami. Am is people, Ami is my people, Lo Ami is not my people. Now what was happening? Well, in the town that Hosea lived, there were people that weren't interested in listening to him. They were indifferent, they ridiculed, they did all sorts of things to him. By the way, I don't think there would be any sensible life insurance agent that would ever have insured the life of a prophet. You go think about that with its implications for our time. Jesus' estimate, thou that killest the prophets, stonest them that are sent unto me. So Hosea was told by the Lord, call your daughter Lo Ruhama. And then a year or two later, his third child, his second son, Lo Ami. Now what happened? Gomer would get the midday meal ready, and the children were playing down the street. And when time came for lunch, Mama Gomer would call out, Lo Ruhama, lunch is ready. Lo Ami, come and get it. And what did the people hear? These are not my people. They have not obtained mercy. And all the while those children were growing up, every time their name was called, a message was given. Now that, of course, not the only time the Lord has done this. Let's find Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 7, or chapter 8 we'll start with. Verses 2 and 3. And the Lord said to Isaiah, go get married. Then he had a son. And the Lord said, verse 1, call his name, and this is the longest name in the Bible. And I wouldn't recommend any young couple here to call their son this name. It's Mehahalal Shazbaz. And again, every time Isaiah called out his son, Mehahalal Shazbaz, come time to take your shower. What did the people hear? What did the people hear? The meaning of that, as the margin will indicate, is the enemy is hasting to the prey. It was a prediction of the coming of the Assyrians. Now that's not the only time it's happened in Isaiah either. In chapter 7, Isaiah is conveying God's message to King Ahaz. And he made a prophecy through that, a very wonderful prophecy, that a virgin shall conceive and have a son whose name, in verse 14, should be Emmanuel. And 650 years later, Gabriel came to a very disturbed widower in Nazareth, the carpenter, engaged to a young lady, whom he suddenly found pregnant. Said to him, don't worry, this is God, this is safe. And when that little boy is born, you are to call his name Yahushua, which in some English tongues becomes Joshua, and through the Greek tongue becomes Jesus. And this is that which fulfilled what was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. So when that little boy was born, God said that his name should be Yahushua Emmanuel. And when Mary called him in for lunch, she called out, "Yehoshia, Emmanuel, supper's ready." And what did those who had ears to hear in terrible Nazareth? "Yahweh is my Savior, and Elohim is with us." This is the method. It's a method used many times. "Your name shall no longer be Abraham, because I am going to breathe into that name, Abraham." And the Spirit entered into him. "Her name is no longer going to be Sarai, because my Spirit is going to infuse Sarah. Your name will be no longer Jacob, but it will be Israel." And you can go through the Bible. Enough of a background. When God proposed to destroy the world by a flood, he raised the first prophet whose name was Enoch. And if you care to find in the 5th chapter of Genesis, Enoch was the first prophet, and he made a prediction when he was 65 years old in Genesis 5:21 in his son, whom he called Methuselah. Now, some of your Bibles may give the meaning of that name in the margin. Anyone here got a meaning? Methu means his death, and Salach means to send. So what it literally means is, at his death, it will be sent. Now, there are some modern, since the last 40 years, commentators are trying to say that it means man of a dart. And I have done considerable excavation in the territory of language, and I don't really see how they have got that. Now, if you look at Salach, it's a very common word. It means to send. That's its basic meaning, to send. Now, what do you send? If I'm sending a baseball from point A to point B, I throw it. So you can send a ball, or you can throw a ball, or you can cast a ball, or you can cast a spear. You can send a spear or an arrow. And the remote, it's got columns and columns in Brown, Driver, and Briggs lexicon. Down at the end, it says it can be used to cast an arrow. Once or twice it's been used. And so this modern commentator has taken that, cast an arrow, and said it's an arrow or a dart. It isn't. It never uses a noun as far as I can find it. It's a verb, salak. Now, Methu, his death, they are translating from a word, meth, which is never found in the Bible, in the singular. It's a very uncommon word, found a few times in the plural, which means men. Now, if they want to say his man will be sent, I could buy that. But it's remarkable, a meaning that has been going on and understood for thousands of years, that carries a very good message. Satan can find some learned man somewhere will come up with some kind of an idea to undermine it. And that's happening more and more. So in my mind, I'm settled that Methu is his death and Salach it will be sent. At his death, it will be sent. Now, some margins of Bibles, King James Bibles, have at his death the sending forth of waters. Now, the sending forth of waters, off waters, is hindsight. All Methuselah means is at his death, it will be sent. Now, if you do a little mathematics, Methuselah was 187 years old when he had Lamech. That's verse 24. 187, remember that? And Lamech was 182, verse 28, when he had Noah. So add 187 and 182 and you get 369. So Methuselah was 369 when Noah was born. According to Genesis 7 verse 11, Noah was 600 years old when the flood came. So add 369 to 600 and you get 969. And go back to Genesis chapter 5 verse 27, and all the days of Methuselah were 969 and he died. Then Patriarchs and Prophets gives a sentence that just before the coming of the flood, Methuselah died. He died in the year of the flood, just before the flood. When he dies, it'll come. Now let's think about that for a little while. For 969, every time Methuselah's name was called, every time you addressed it and said, "Hi, Methuselah," you said, "When he dies, it'll come." Just like every time you say the word Jesus, Yahweh is my Savior. Every time you say Emmanuel, you say El or Elohim is abiding with us. God has come down to us and is saving us. It's very interesting to know that in 1863, when the name of the Seventh-day Adventist was selected, the inspired commentary came, "This name is valuable because it conveys a message." As Elder Kuhn mentioned today, Seventh-day Adventist. You begin to think, what does that mean, Seventh-day Adventist? I was the pastor of the last church. It was a hard job, but I tried to work at it. That the secretary, every time she answered the telephone of the church, said the whole thing. It was the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And when we had the seminary in the Far East, we called it the Seventh-day Adventist Theological Seminary, Far East. Some people complained it was a mouthful. Well, it's all right. After the first 50 times, it comes easy. And it conveys a message. You've got to give it a geographical name. This is Putinkahoy Seminary. What's Putinkahoy? A barrio of 75 houses. No, the name conveys the message. Now, why do you think Methuselah was given enough health and vigor to live longer than any man? God's mercy to that generation. And I can imagine, I like to speculate, Noah would take his great-grandfather up on the scaffolding when he was preaching and said, "Look at this mossy old man. Why do you think God has kept him alive? When he dies, he's going to come. God's giving you a chance." They laughed at him. Then he died, and it came. Now notice the second point. Prophet number one made a prediction that nearly 500 years later was applied by another prophet. More than 500 years later. And the second prophet took the first prophet's prophetic truth and made it present truth and applied it to his generation. And the second prophet's message perfectly jived with the previous prophet's message. And the second prophet organized a remnant whose faith rested on fulfilling prophecy applied by the second prophet. And that remnant, after all the shaking and after all the effect of years of time, it takes time to settle into the truth. It takes time to come to grips with each doubt and each question and settle it. That remnant met the crisis and went into the next generation. So now my hypothesis is this. It's more than a hypothesis, but it starts now as one for you, the thesis. God will do nothing, but he makes a prophetic statement concerning it. He gives a time prophecy, indefinite, that's later applied by a prophet whose message of present truth takes prophetic truth and applies it to that generation. Jesus says, "As it was the days of Noah, so shall it be the days of the Son of Man." Christ gives eschatological emphasis to the deluge story. Now let's look at chart number two. The next epoch dealt with the Exodus. In Genesis 15, God said to Abraham, the affliction of the children of Israel is going to be for 400 years. The sojourn happened to be 430. Now we don't need any more to go into many details of this. But near the end of that 400-year period of affliction that was started by Hagar the Egyptian afflicting the seed, that was the opening salvo of battle that raged back and forth for four centuries. Somewhere near the end of that 400-year period, God raised up prophet number two, whose name was Moses. He took Abraham's prophetic truth and went to Pharaoh and said, the time has come, let my people go. He went to the leaders of Israel and said to them, the time has come, get ready to go. Take possession of the land that is promised. Through all the crisis at the close of that period, that lasted for several decades, a remnant was finally sifted out, a pathetically fragile, tiny remnant of two, finally made the promised land. Here again you see the thesis repeated. God's not going to do anything, but he will reveal his secret to his servant the prophet. So Abraham makes a prediction, a specific prediction of 400 years. And then we read in Exodus 12, 40 and 41, and it came to pass on the selfsame day it came to pass. The children of Israel went out. Now I can imagine Moses writing that out under inspiration and realizing it. And he knew the date of that time that Hagar the Egyptian mocked. My, this is the exact anniversary. 400 days later. Now this business of days disturbs some people, but don't let it disturb you. Don't let it disturb you. I came here last, I don't quite remember, but I think it was 12 camp meetings ago. Any of you remember more specifically? Maybe so. 12 camp meetings ago. I have two anniversaries, one in September of this year, and then the next one, God willing, if we are alive, will be our 50th. So we've had 48 anniversaries, 48 days. Each day is a year. Three Christmases from now, or two Christmases ago, or five Thanksgivings ago, whatever you want to do it, so many days ago. But you don't worry about days. You know the idiom. And the Bible does exactly the same thing. Talking about an anniversary. 2300 days are days of atonement. After 2300 cycles of days of atonement, the sanctuary is going to be cleansed. And it's very easy to go to the Bible. Take your concordance, Young's Concordance. Look up day. Do your homework for a couple of weeks. Follow all the texts through. A biblical idiom, simple as we use it today. Then, as he noted, exactly the same day, 400 anniversaries before this affliction had started. Now it's fulfilled. So a prophet makes a time prophecy applied by a prophet. He takes prophetic truth, makes it present truth, preaches and organizes a remnant, goes into the next generation. Now let's look at epoch number three. This had to do with the exile. This is the captivity of the children of Israel. Captivity is a long word, and exile is easy to spell. Jeremiah made a prediction of 70 years. Near the end of it, Daniel chapter 9, verse 2, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of years spoken of by Jeremiah that God would accomplish 70 years. Not see any way by which the captivity will end in the political climate, and so he begins to pray. And then in chapter 10, you remember he got sick at the beginning. Gabriel came, Gabriel told, make this man understand. Gabriel says, I've been having a tough time with the king of Persia. He wouldn't listen, but Messiah came. Messiah the prince came and helped me. Nobody knew that. There's no Persian record of that. They couldn't see Messiah the prince, so they couldn't see Gabriel. But Cyrus was persuaded, and he signed the decree. And the children of Israel builded and prospered according to the prophesying of Zechariah, Haggai in Palestine, and Daniel in the Persian Empire. A prophet, Jeremiah, makes a specific time prophecy that near its consummation is applied by three prophets. Now let's go to epoch number 4. This has to do with the coming of Christ. This is the most spectacular prediction ever made. The more I study it, the more I am amazed. Daniel the prophet predicted through the inspiration given to him by the Spirit and interpreted by Gabriel, that from the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem in 457, so many years would be required, 49 in building the temple, there would be extension of years, making 483 altogether, to the time of Messiah the prince. In order to be a prince, you've got to select your father with care. Did you know that? He's got to be a king. The anointing of the king's son. Mashiach is to anoint. Mashiach is the anointing. He's the anointed one. Until the anointing of the king's son, from this will be 483 years. Then for 1 week he will continue the covenant with his people. In the midst of the week he will be cut off and he will make sacrifice and oblation to cease. And near the fulfillment of that, God raised up the greatest of the prophets, according to the testimony of Christ, John the Baptist, whose message was, the axe is laid to the root of the tree. 6 months later, Jesus Christ came with the proclamation, the time is fulfilled. You ever thought about that axe? What tree? Jesus told a story about a tree. How many years did he come looking for fruit? 3 years. The gardener says, let it alone for one more year. If you add the 6 months of John the Baptist's ministry, which started with the axe laid to the root of the tree, then you add the 3.5 years of Christ's ministry, you get 4 years, at the termination of which Jesus Christ came, according to the gospel narrative, to a certain tree. You look it up in the Greek. It's a special tree. Didn't have any fruit. That's the end. The next day, the disciples were amazed that it had immediately withered. 4 years. Axe is laid. Time is fulfilled. The prophet Daniel made prophetic truth that Jesus Christ, the prophet that Moses predicted. You remember, a prophet, the Lord your God, raise up from among your brethren like unto me. John was asked, art thou that prophet? No, Jesus was that prophet. But John the Baptist was also a prophet. So at the time this prediction is fulfilled, God raised up 2 prophets to take prophetic truth and apply it as present truth and organize a remnant, which happened to be the Christian church, that met the crisis and went on. Now let's look at epoch number 5. The longest prophecy is the 2300 days made by Daniel that ended in 1844. Now we come to the punchline. God never changes, okay? He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Agreed? He won't do anything, but he will reveal his secret to his servants, the prophets, and he has shown his methodology. A prophet, Daniel, made a specific time prophecy of 2300 years that ended in 1844. At the end of that prophetic period, you've got to find the prophet. Begin to look. Some of my friends don't like Ellen White. Well, you better start looking, friend. You better look. If you can't find one, invent one. Or else the Seventh-day Adventist church is in a mess. They haven't fitted in with the prophetic picture. All right, now you remember what Jesus Christ said in Matthew 24 and Luke 17? When the disciples said to him, they asked him two questions. He was talking about the great stones that Herod was using to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. He said, you know, the day is coming and not one stone's going to be left upon another. See, that temple was full of gold. And when the temple was torched in AD 70, the gold melted, went in between those stones. And the looters and the Roman soldiers said, there's gold in them, thar hills. And they moved those stones. There was one, not one left upon another. And they asked him two questions. When will this be when there won't be a stone on another? And what will be the sign of thy coming of the end of the world? Jesus answered them. Both answers. He said there would be many false prophets. The devils believe and tremble. They know. And the best way to confuse is to bring in a whole bunch of counterfeits. I was reading in some magazine that I won't advertise, that those who are studying the 19th century, that's the 1800s, are finding many evidences of prophets in 18th century America. And the argument is that Ellen White was caught up. She's a woman of our times, and she was in that movement. Well, if there weren't many prophets, then Christ's prediction is not fulfilled, because he said there will arise many false Christs. And you haven't got to believe the false Christs. You've got to try them according to this Bible criteria. Now, the first criteria that I would suggest is that the true prophet in 1844 has got to take the prophetic truth of Daniel that deals with the 2300 days, with all the implications of that, of the cleansing of the sanctuary and the casting down of the saints and the place of the sanctuary and the daily and everything else connected with it, and make that prophetic truth present truth, applicable to us in these days. You've got to do that. You know, some years ago, Molly and I went to the camp meeting in the Academy of New York State, Union Springs. And somebody said, why don't you take a trip and go and see the field of Hiram Edson? Good. Somebody could steer us where that is in the country, we'd be happy to go there. And he said, while you're looking there, why don't you go to the hill Cumorah? And the little grove, beautiful beech grove nearby, where Joseph Smith, in the year Ellen White was born, 1826, got his vision. He was told by the angel Moroni, you go to the hill Cumorah and you dig in a certain place and you'll find the golden plates. You'll be given a special lens. Look at it, translate it, write it out, make the Book of Mormon. And while you're there, why don't you go to the little town where the Fox sisters lived? You know, we found that these three little places were in a circle 15 miles in diameter. Spiritualism, Mormonism, and Adventism were born right there. How do you know which is right? What are the criteria you use? Now, that same trip, we had to go into New England, some camp meeting up in northern New England. So we went through the Shaker country, and we saw where Sister Anne, the gift of prophecy, had functioned. And we also chased around where Mary Baker Eddy went, about four or five of her homes, beautifully kept. You know, when you go in there, you're a captive audience. You can't tell this very kindly, genial lady that you want to go, and you're in a hurry. She gives you a sermon. That's what she's there for. We heard the same thing four times. We got to know what they believed. Now, there are five prophets right there. What do you do with them? You check them. Test them with the Bible. How many of them are interested in the cleansing of the sanctuary? How many of them are interested in the 2300 days? Only one. That wasn't Mary Baker Eddy either. That was Ellen White. Right at the right time, with the right kind of message, fitting in with the Bible, taking prophetic truth and making it present truth, with all the implications, you do all your study and you check. She is the only one that fulfills all the criteria. Now, I'm the Spirit of Prophecy fellow for the Southern California Conference. And I must confess, if I go and talk about the same sermon every time, I get bored stiff. And so I thought to myself, well, now let's restudy it. Let's study the Bible. For example, how many functions have all the prophets in the Bible carried out? First of all, you've got to make a list of all the prophets. I said, good, I assume you're able to do that. I haven't done it yet. How many prophets do you think there are in the Bible? My list now, there are about 120. They're not all called prophet. They're called man of God. They're called seers. And the word of the Lord came to so-and-so saying, go to so-and-so. I'm making a list of all the prophets. Then what they have to do? What did Gad have to do? You know what Gad had to do? How many things did Nathan have to do? How many things did Edo have to do? By the way, Gad established the musical form of Israelite worship. Nathan had to do something else. Elisha had to do something else. Isaiah had a different job. John the Baptist had a different job. Make a list and define the job description of each of the prophets. That's been a thrill. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm working at it, and it'll take a long, several sermons to preach it so I can do piecemeal. And I'm not sure, but I think there are between 50 and 60 different functions that the prophets have fulfilled. All of them together. A composite picture of the prophetic gift in action. No biblical prophet has done them all. But Ellen White has. All right, now what happens to a prophet when a prophet is taken off in vision? Make a list. Give or take, I haven't finished it yet, it's between 20 and 30. That didn't happen to all the prophets. One prophet says one thing, one prophet says another thing, and one prophet says another thing that happened to him. Some prophets say five or six. Make a list. Now you're making grids of checking that you can put over the ministry of Ellen White to check. And it checks out beautifully. Beautifully. What they did. What happened to them? How were prophets treated? Make a list. Start with Jeremiah. What did they do to Jeremiah? Besides jailing him and eventually stoning him in Egypt. Make a list. What did they say about him? What kind of snide remarks did they make? Were they ever sarcastic? Were they ever ironical? Were they ever derogatory? Did they ever tell lies about him? Did they ever make up stories about him? You make a list of all the things that were said to prophets, including that, go up, Baldy, go up, Baldy. Well, they got a spanking with a couple of she-bears. I don't know what a bear's paw would feel like on one's gluteals, but they learned, those teenagers. All right, so you make a list of all the things that would indicate how a prophet was treated. Now, of course, Ellen White wasn't treated like them all. She wasn't made to crawl inside a hollow log, as Isaiah was, and then be sawn in two. But metaphorically, she'd been stoned many times. He is still being stoned. So you get a picture, and I'm trying to get a biblical picture of prophetism. All the Bible, every time they're mentioned, getting them in, setting them down, making a grid. What did they do? What effect had the gift of prophecy on them? How were they treated? What kind of ministry did they have? How did they write? What did they write? And compare them with what's happening in the 19th and early 20th century as a check. This is the criteria. This is what you check by. This is what you check by. So at the time, with the prophetic truth becoming present truth, then fitting in with all the biblical criteria by which we assess and evaluate and check true prophetism, in a whole milieu of many false prophets and charismatic effects of gifts, she emerges. Now, you know, I said at the beginning that I think God chuckles. Many years ago, I was in Newbold in England, and the country, the government, state, whatever it is, county, gives examinations, and accounting and typing and shorthand and all sorts of things. So it's fun just to take the examination. You pay a little fee, doesn't matter if you pass, if you don't pass, that's fine. So I took an exam in advanced typing, just for fun. There was somebody else trying to do it, and we challenged each other, and the only way to do it fairly, take it, pay your 3 and 6 and go and get your examination and see what it's like. And I discovered then that every 5 taps constitute 1 word, an average. And if you got 10 words, you got 50 taps. Now, with 10 words, you have a possibility of 50 mistakes. Isn't that right? Now, don't laugh. The other day I was typing on my Selectric 2, and I started on the 2 wrong notes, and every letter was wrong. You ever done that? If you haven't done it, I've got a gift. There's no mistake that I'm incapable of making sometime. Now, if you had only to type 5 words, the maximum mistakes you could make would be 50. Do you know how many words Mrs. White wrote? 25 million. Do you know what the possibility of error lies in 25 million words? Many. Untold. Now, we live in a day when everything can be retrieved. They've got our writings on the laser, on discs, and you can retrieve. I was in Andrews for a week of prayer, and I wanted to see how it worked, so I went in there, and the man said, what do you want? I said, well, let's put cherubim. So he punches it in, and he talks to me, and pretty soon it comes out, and it begins to indicate every time she said cherubim and cherub. So it's retrievable. Now, if the Lord was afraid of mistakes, he wouldn't get a third grader to produce 25 million words at a time of the earth's history when every word and every syllable can be retrieved. He wouldn't do it. But he did. And I think he's got a sense of humor. He's chuckling to himself and says, let them find a mistake if they can. On September 1, it will be 51 years since I begun my internship. And I'll tell something now that I have told many times before. If you know a genuine mistake in this book or in the writings of Mrs. White, please tell me. Not something you don't understand. That's your problem. But a mistake There are many things I didn't understand 50 years ago that I can see now. And if you're patient with yourself, as I've asked many a student to be when they've come to me struggling, be patient with yourself. You're going to grow. You're going to learn. You're going to be gathering bits and pieces from everywhere that will suddenly come and form a concept. Be patient with yourself. You haven't learned everything. They've come to me in college and said, well, I never heard that before. Well, that's what you're paying your tuition for, son. Listen. You got two of them. Now, if you know a genuine mistake in the Bible or the spirit of prophecy, tell me. And I will be happy, prayerfully, to do my homework and study it. And I've said this in camp meetings that have numbered five times the size of this. And nobody has shown me a genuine mistake yet. And I don't believe there are any. I went to Johns Hopkins for 2 years. Then I dropped out. I'm a university dropout. I couldn't take it anymore. I was given a scholarship, so I didn't waste any of the Lord's money. Didn't cost anything, except gasoline. An old 29. I came back near Spencerville one day and pulled over on the soft shoulder and had a talk with the Lord. I'm going to quit. If you want me to get a PhD, please find me someplace. I can't take this. Nothing in the Bible. We're studying the Bible. Nothing in the Bible was right. You got to amend it. You've got to edit it. You've got to do all sorts of things to it. And the more ingenuity you could display by getting something from Ugarit or something from Nuzi or something from Aramaic or something from Arabic or something from Ethiopic or any other Semitic language that you could dream up to modify it and show yourself smart, that's how to get a grade. And I quit. Right at that time, Thiele, EMC, had just published his book, The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings. And every Wednesday, the seminar that was held there at 9 o'clock, the latest books were reviewed. And the professor happened to be Albright, had this Thiele's book, Mysterious Numbers, and he briefly said it purported to find a solution of all the reigning figures that had been given for the kings. And he says Thiele is attempting to show that they are reasonable, that they fit in, but he says this is, of course, too good to be true. That's how he dismissed it. See, his concept was that nobody could write accurately. Too good to be true. He hadn't really studied it. Since that time, it's been acclaimed. Years later, it's as valid as the day it was written, with two or three emendations that he's made to strengthen it in the revised edition. They were correct. Those figures are correct. And I could tell you all kinds of amusing stories about people who have said they found mistakes. I remember getting a call, made my telephone, you know, I had to hold it about that far away. Somebody was very disturbed at the end. He had heard me say that I hadn't found a mistake in writing. So I got one here in Prophets and Kings. I said, let me get mine. I forget now what page it was. And he found it, and I found it, and he says, there it is, there's the mistake. It was on the left-hand page, about that far down. It said that Daniel and company had been taken captive by Assyria. He said, any school kid knows it was Babylon that had taken them captive. Assyria was for Israel 100 and so many years before. Now, while he was barking, I turned the page. It started with a sentence already begun and a couple lines below. I saw it was a quotation, quotation marks. So I followed the quotation and it went right through Assyria. And two or three lines down, the quotations ended with a footnote, and I looked down, and he was still going strong, and I saw that now this was part of a quotation by Ezekiel. So when he finished, I said to them, would you care to turn to the previous page, line so-and-so, see where the quotes begin? Yeah. I said, well, follow those quotes and tell me when they end. So he followed them down, he ended. I said, what's a footnote? Who wrote that? He says, I guess it was Ezekiel. I said, quit guessing. Who wrote that? He said, Ezekiel. I said, not Ellen White? No. I said, why do you say she made a mistake? She's only quoting Ezekiel. She's quoting the Bible. And I said, I'll be quite frank with you. I don't like people like you who put your mouth into gear without switching on your brain. I don't like it one bit. I don't know who you are. But before you start talking like this, do a little homework. And I hope he's got peace of mind and the Lord has forgiven him. Now, most of the trouble, people have failed to read. And I can tell you tonight, I have never been shown an error in either the Bible or the spirit of prophecy. Now I hear people say there are mistakes there. I say, now please tell me. I've got to find them first. I'm only saying I have never found one. And they're still showing me. When you do your homework just like this, you find it fits in very, very nicely. So as I have studied the writings of the Spirit of Prophecy from the biblical point of view, Ellen White came at the right time. The termination of the Millerite movement and during the birth pangs of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. She took the prophetic message of Daniel and then and since then has made it present truth for the people of the God in the last days. There is nothing that Seventh-day Adventists do as a denomination that's worth a hoot that didn't come from Ellen White.
Right.
You do some thinking. You take all our health work. Spent some years in Far East. Visited other parts of the world. You stop and talk. Stop and talk and see, oh, you're the people at the hospitals. Yes, I was there. I remember talking to a fellow in Singapore. I looked around, and by the color of his skin, I thought he could speak my language, and I sidled up and talked to him. Where are you going? I'm going to Manila. So am I. Where do you live? Well, I live in Bel Air. Well, Bel Air is like Beverly Hills Plus. So I knew he had enough pesos to get all the punts that he wanted. And I got talking to him. He said, what are you? So I said, I'm Seventh-day Adventist missionary. We're trying to establish. Oh, he says, that's attached to Manila. That's where I get my bread, he says. Nobody knows that. This fellow, wealthy man. Whenever he's passing by, he goes and buys a loaf of their good bread. I talked to another fellow there. Oh, that's where my daughter was born. Is Dr. So-and-so still there? Why wasn't sudden such a place? Anywhere you want to go. Our health work. Whatever the state it might be, whatever we might say about it, is one of our outstanding qualities. Doing a work. You go to Manila, you go to Seoul, you go to Tokyo, you go to Hong Kong, you go to Singapore, wherever you go. Health work. What about our educational work? What about our medical work? What about our publishing work? What about our dietary contribution? Change the breakfast habits of the civilized world. All started in the kitchen of that lady. Posts and Kellogg's making messes. I hope they cleaned up. Helping. Then you think of all the contribution that was made to understanding the scriptures. I've been a Bible teacher for many years. Most of the ideas I get nudged into my brain from the books I read that she wrote. Little clues. Put them together. Think about them. I made a compilation. Some of you have shown me one. I started off and thought I'd like to get everything that Ellen White wrote and also I taught teaching sanctuary. So in Union College, I made a collection on the sanctuary and the book of Revelation. I had about 600 pages on the book of Revelation. I was thrilled. And I thought I'd give it to my students and they'd be thrilled. And when they saw a 600-page book, they nearly lynched me. And so I boiled it down to all the essentials I began to boil down they didn't want. They didn't want. Could you write 600 pages on the book of Revelation? Maybe you'd need a postage stamp and you'd have enough room to put your address on the back of it too. What could you write? Write out, got about 600 pages on the book of Romans. I've made compilations on the sanctuary, on Daniel, and Revelation, on the prophets. Pages and pages of material, verse by verse. Written a little here, a little there, in a carriage here, 2 o'clock in the morning there. When you get it all together from all our writings, they fit right in. 25 million words of a gold mine. Started with a third grader. I wonder why I went 27 years to school. She could do that as a third grade. She dropped out of the third grade. Yeah, I said God chuckled. God chuckled. This is what I can do. Somebody surrenders to me. 25 million words. Five times that. Possible errors. Find them. Go read. By osmosis, you will discover the most thrilling insights into the Word of God that you will ever find. All right, now we live in a time of crisis. I remember talking to a fellow, conference president, put me on to him. He's got a problem. Can you help him? I was at a workers' meeting. So I worked and worked and worked. We had a nice time. Became friends. He had a problem with words. How does inspiration work? Well, it's ideas. Doesn't matter where the words come from. Now all he's hepped up about is words. These words were borrowed from there, and these words were borrowed from there, and these words were borrowed from there, and these words. And he smacks over it a great label that he borrowed from Canwrite. And the word is plagiarism. Canwrite was the fellow that first applied that to Ellen White. Now, what is this stuff called plagiarism? Do you ever read magazines that you don't intend to buy? Well, now, my wife was at the counter the other day in Glendale, and there was a magazine standing there, so I picked one up while she was going through. I had no intention of buying it. It was Architectural Review. It's a kind of fluffy magazine. It cost more than I wanted to pay. But in there was an article on what an architect had done on a trip to Europe, a portfolio of an architect's vacation. Had 7 or 8 beautiful photographs. He had taken some grill work, he had taken a window, he had taken an arch, he had taken an alcove and all sorts of other things. And he said, this is the way you get ideas for decoration and planning. And he was planning to incorporate all those things into the buildings that he was going to build. Now, is that plagiarism? Of course not. The building that you build is unique. But it may have a window that looks like something that came out of Seville in Spain. It may have some ironwork that you got an idea somewhere in your trip to Mexico. It may have a roof that you had seen on a journey to Norway or in some book.
And you make a potpourri of all the ideas you get, but your product is new. There is nothing new under the sun. It only becomes new by arrangement. Landscaping is rearranging dirt. You didn't invent anything about it. You rearranged it. And you rearrange words. I remember a facetious farmer in Scotland told a friend of mine when we were up there canvassing in 1932, I got everything written in that book, I don't need it. And this fellow said, no. You got that book? No, he said, I haven't got that book. He says, where have you got everything? He says, in my dictionary. It's only rearranged in this book. It's when you take some finished product and claim it as your own. Not when you gather together. There is no other book ever written like Desire of Ages. I don't care how many places she quotes from. That book is unique.
Amen.
Never has another book like that. And if any of you have done anything creative, quotes, in your life, you're borrowed from every place you've got. But the end product is what makes it unique. Have you ever been surprised what a mess some people can make out of apples and flour and sugar and shortening? Have you ever been surprised? And somebody else can take those same four things and make a masterpiece that make my salivary glands gallop like Niagara. So you can take all these things, but there's never been a book written like Patriarchs and Prophets. A little bit about Marsh's night scenes, a little bit about something else, a little bit somewhere here. But when you look at the whole books, it's unique. So don't make a straw man and then fight the straw man or straw woman. We live in an age when God's truths and prophecies are coming into focus. Very soon the end will be. No more prophetic periods. This is the end. Nothing more in the future. Jesus Christ will soon be here. Will you be ready? Will I be ready? You know, my dad was a wonderful fellow. We talked about this many, many times. Lived in Loma Linda. Born in Burma. When he saw that he had to leave India, wondered where he would go. He visited Australia and New Zealand and England and a few other places. And when he got to Loma Linda, he said, like Brigham Young, this is it. Nice and warm. He loved it hot. And he's lying there in Montecito under a deodar tree today. Good man. If I can make it, I'll see him. You know, we talked about it, about the latter rain. He used to teach Sabbath school class, till he was about 84. He'd spend sometimes 30 hours studying one lesson. And the only way they could control the size of his class was to put him into a little room. That's what they did. And he'd laugh. He said, well, I seat 30 people here. I'll put 30 chairs and they'd be there every Sabbath. And he'd prepare. He knew. He'd write it out and over and edit it and go over it. We talked about the latter rain, the early rain, the shaking, and the sealing. And you know, all that must have happened to him or he'll never make it. Do you know that? I don't know how many of us will be alive at next camp meeting. I went to this health center and they told me how many more years I could expect. I don't know whether I'll make it. I may hit a semi and that would be the end.
But that doesn't matter. The latter rain must be making fruit ripe in my personality now. We've built a myth. We think it's some future time when the latter rain is going to fall. Some of us won't be here next year. We'll be waiting. The Lord will have put us to rest. The next time will be a celebration when we see him. I don't worry about that. It can come any time it wants. When he's ready, I hope I'm ready. Now the latter rain must come into your life. You won't be able to do much good if you haven't got the former rain that has started to set the fruit, because the latter rain just ripens it. Have you settled into the truth? Or does every little whim of doctrine set you shivering? What have I believed all these years? How is it with you? The sealing is the settling into the truth. You settled in? Time we did. You know, I've often said, and some of my friends don't like it, but I think the most powerful thing is a closed mind. I'm a great believer in the closed mind. On September the 3rd, 1935, in the Holloway Church in London, before a preacher, when he asked me, "Will you have this woman to be your lawful wedded wife?" I said, "I will." You know, I closed my mind to other women after that. I closed my eyes to other women after that. A marriage can only last with the power of a closed mind. If your mind is roving, you've got a problem. Elder Spicer gave me the charge when he ordained me in London, 1938. No other job for me. No other call, no other appeal. My mind was closed. Wherever God wanted me, if he helped me, I was ready to go. The decisions we make in our lives close alternatives. I've accepted Jesus, my mind is closed. I've accepted his Sabbath, my mind is closed. I've studied decades and I've come to the conclusion that Ellen White is the prophet of the remnant. I'm settled. Somebody brings me a problem, let's study it. Let's see. I got the whole package. The whole package. A year ago, I went to Andrews. And I took Molly along with her. We wanted to see our friends at Berrien. The Friday we got there was the coldest Friday known to Berrien. And I wondered at my judgment at leaving Southern California, but I was there. And I wrote to my daughter, our daughter, in Santa Barbara, and said, "I don't trust Mother. I am taking her with me to Andrews." All right, now, a historian is going to write that little episode up in a paragraph in a history of the Hardings. How is he going to interpret that? Right, so it depends upon the quality of your mind. If you're on Molly's side and you read that letter, all you've got is the stubs of the airline ticket to Andrews and this bit of letter to Judy. Now you're going to write a history. What do you do with that? Now, if you're on Molly's side, you say, "Les is projecting." See? If you're on my side, you say, "He's suspicious of her. He's a good-looking 70-year-old down the lane. But you know, you would be totally wrong. We live on the side of a hill. You got to go up a very steep drive, and then you've got to go up cement steps. And she has a very shaky right knee. And I'm scared to death one day she is going to fall. As my mother fell, and that was the end. As Ellen White fell, and that was the end. So what I don't trust about Molly is not her morals, but her ability to stay on her two pins. So it depends on the kind of mind you have, how you interpret. And there are many people interpreting by the way their minds are, not by the way the facts are. What I'm submitting to you tonight is that as intelligent, adult, Seventh-day Adventist human beings, you decide calmly, quietly, on the evidence, to settle into it. And then, day by day, ensure that you are ready. That fair? That reasonable? Is that biblical? Then every wind of doctrine that comes whistling about our ears will just be recognized for what it is. Gales of wind produced by the flapping of those bat wings of the old devil called Satan, trying to disturb us, trying to upset us. God has not failed. He's shown himself the same. His word has been carried out. When you see it, then believe. God will keep you through to the kingdom.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.